Chapter 32, The 923rd Annual Book World Awards. The annual Book World Awards, or Bookies, were instigated in 1063 CE and for the first 200 years were dominated by Aeschylus and Homer, who won most of the awards in the 30 or so categories. Following the expansion in fiction and the inclusion of the oral tradition, categories totaled 200 by 1423. Technical awards were introduced 20 years later and included Most Used English Word and the Most Wildly Misspelt Word, which has remained a contentious subject ever since. By 1879, there were over 600 categories, but neither the length of the awards nor the vote-rigging scandal in 1964 has dented the popularity of this glittering occasion. It will remain one of the bookworld's most popular fixtures for years to come. Commander Trafford Bradshaw, CBE. Bradshaw's Guide to the Bookworld. I stood off stage at the Starlight Room, one in a long line of equally minor celebrities, all awaiting our turn to go and read the nominations. The hospitality lounge, where we had all been mustered, was about the size of a football pitch, and the massed babble of excited voices sounded like rushing water. I had been trying to avoid Tweed all evening. But whenever I lost him, Heap would take over. There were others about, too. Bradshaw had pointed out Orlick and Legree, two other assistants of Tweed's that he thought I should be wary of. Of them all, Heap was the most amateur. His skills at unobserved observation were woefully inadequate. "Well," he said when I caught him staring at me, "you and me both waiting for awards." He rubbed his hands and tapped his long fingers together. "I ask you, me all humble and you an outlander. Thanks to you and this Miss Bailing incident, I'm up for most creepy character in a Dickens novel. What would you be up for?" "I'm giving one, not accepting one, Uriah. And why are you following me?" "Apologies, ma'am," he said, squirming slightly and clasping his hands together to try to stop them from moving. "Mr. Tweed asked me to keep a particular close eye on you in case of an attack, ma'am." "Oh, yes," I replied, unimpressed by the lame cover story. "From whom?" "Those who would wish you harm, of course. Procaths, Bowdlerizers, even the townspeople from Shadow. It was them what tried to kill you at Solomon's, I'll be bound." Sadly, it was true. There had been two attempts on my life since Dean's arrest. The first had been a tiger released in Kenneth's office. I thought at first it was Big Martin catching up with me, but it wasn't. Bradshaw had dealt with the creature. He sent it on a one-way trip to Zenobian's. The second had been a contract killing. Fortunately for me, Heap's handwriting was pretty poor, and Thursby from the Maltese Falcon was shot instead. It was only because I was an outlander that I was still alive. If I'd been a generic, Tex Grand Central could have erased me at source long ago. "Mr. Tweed said the outlanders have to stick together," carried on Heap, "and look after each other. Outlanders have a duty." "This is all really very sweet of him," I interrupted, "but I can look after myself. Good luck with your award. I'm sure you'll win." "Thank you," he said, fidgeting for a moment before moving off a little way and continuing to stare at me in an unsubtle manner. I was summoned towards the stage where I could see the Master of Ceremonies winding up the previous award. He reminded me of Adrian Lush, all smiles, insincerity and bouffant hair. "So," he carried on, "teleportation, a clear winner for the most implausible premise in a sci-fi novel, which was hard luck on and they lived happily after, which won last year. If I could thank all the nominees and especially Ginger Hebblethwaite for presenting it." There was applause. A freckled youth in a flying jacket waved to the crowd and winked at me as he trotted off stage. The MC took a deep breath and consulted his list. Unlike awards at home, there was no TV coverage, as no one in the book world had a TV. You didn't need one. The generics who had remained in the books as a skeleton staff to keep the stories in order were kept up to date with a live footnotophone link from the Starlight Room. With all the usual characters away at the awards, fiction wasn't quite so good, but no one generally noticed. This was often the reason people in the Outland argued over the quality of a recommended book. They had read it during the bookies. The next award, ladies and gentlemen, and, things, is to be given by the newest jurisfiction agent to join the ranks of the Bookworld's own policing agency. Fresh from a glittering career in the Outland and engineer of the improved ending to Jane Eyre, may I present Thursday Next. There was applause and I walked on, smiling dutifully. I shook the hand of the MC and looked out into the auditorium. It was vast, really vast. The Starlight Room was the largest single-function room ever described in any book. A lit candelabra graced each of the 100,000 tables, and as I looked into the room, all I could see was a never-ending field of white lights, flickering in the distance like stars. 7 million characters were here tonight. But by using a convenient temporal field displacement technology borrowed from the boys in the sci-fi genre, everyone in the room had a table right next to the stage and could hear and see us with no problems at all. "Good evening," I said, staring out at the sea of faces. "I am here to read the nominations and announce the winner of the Best Chapter Opening in the English Language category." I started to feel hot under the lights. I composed myself and read the back of the envelope. The nominations are The Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe, Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh, and A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. I waited until the applause had died down and then opened the envelope. And the winner is Brideshead Revisited! There was thunderous applause and I smiled dutifully as the MC bent closer to the microphone. "Wonderful," he said enthusiastically as the applause subsided. "Let's hear the winning paragraph, shall we?" He placed the short section of writing into the imaginotransference device that had been installed on the stage. But this wasn't a recording ITD like the ones they used to create books in the well. It was a transmitter. The words of War's story were read by the machine and projected directly into the crowd's imagination. "I have been here before," I said. I had been there before, first with Sebastian more than 20 years ago on a cloudless day in June, when the ditches were creamy with meadowsweet and the air heavy with the scents of summer. It was a day of peculiar splendour, and although I had been there so often, in so many moods, it was to that first visit that my heart returned on this, my latest... There was more applause from the guests, and when finally it stopped, the MC announced... "Mr. Waugh can't be with us tonight, so I would like to ask Sebastian to accept the award on his behalf." There was a drum roll and a brief alarum of music as Sebastian walked from his table up the steps to the podium and, after kissing me on the cheek, shook the MC's hand warmly. "Goodness," he said, taking a swig from the glass he had brought with him. "It's a great honour to accept the award on behalf of Mr. Waugh. I know he would want me to thank Charles, from whose mouth all the words spring, and also Lord Marchmain for his excellent death scene. My mother, of course, and Julia, Cords..."
"What about me?"
said a small voice from the bride's head table. "I was getting to you, Aloysius." Sebastian cleared his throat and took another swig. "Of course, I would also like to say that we in Brideshead could not have done it all on our own. I'd like to thank all the other characters in previous works who have done so much to lay the groundwork. I'd particularly like to mention Captain Grimes, Margot Mechaland, and Lord Copper. In addition..." He droned on like this for almost 20 minutes, thanking everyone he could think of before finally taking the bookie statuette and returning to his table. I was thanked by the MC and walked off the stage feeling really quite relieved, the voice of the MC echoing behind me. "And for the next category, most incomprehensible plot in any genre, we are now pleased to welcome someone who has kindly taken a few hours' leave of his grueling schedule of sadistic galactic domination. Ladies, gentlemen, and things, His Supreme Holiness, Emperor Zark."
"You're on,"
I whispered to the Emperor, who was trying to calm his nerves with a quick cigarette in the wings.
"How do I look? Enough to strike terror in the hearts of millions of merciless life forms?"
"Terrifying. Have you got the envelope?" He patted his thick black cloak until he found it and held it up, gave a wan smile, took a deep breath and strode purposefully onto the stage to screams of terror and boos. I re-entered the Starlight Room as the most incomprehensible plot was awarded for the fifth year running to the Magus. I glanced at my watch. There was an hour to go until the last and most prestigious award was due to be announced. The most troubled romantic lead, male. It was a hot contest, and the odds had been fluctuating all day. Heathcliff was the clear favourite at 7-2. He had won it 77 times in a row, and ever conscious of someone trying to steal his thunder, he had been altering his words and actions subtly to keep the crown firmly on his head, something the opposition had also been attempting. Jude Fawley had been trying to spike his own plot to add drama, and even Hamlet was not averse to a subtle amount of plot shifting. He had hammed up his madness so much he had to be sent on a cruise to calm him down. I passed a table populated entirely by rabbits.
"Waiter!"
called one of them, thumping his rear paw to get attention.
"More dandelion leaves for table 8, if you please, sir."
"Good evening, Miss Next."
It was the Bradshaws. I was glad to see that they had not been swayed by convention. Mrs. Bradshaw had decided to attend after all. "Good evening, Commander. Good evening, Mrs. Bradshaw. Nice dress you're wearing."
"Do you think so?" asked Mrs. Bradshaw slightly nervously. "Trafford wanted me to wear something full length, but I think this little Coco Chanel cocktail number is rather fetching, don't you?"
"Black suits your eyes," I told her, and she smiled demurely.
"I've got the thing you wanted me to keep for you," whispered Bradshaw under his breath. "Appreciate a girl who knows how to delegate. Say the word, and it's yours."
"I'm waiting for the announcement of Ultra Word," I hissed. "Tweed is on my back. Don't let him get it, no matter what."
"Don't worry a little head about that," he said, nodding towards Mrs. Bradshaw. "The Mem Sahib's in the loop. She may look a delicate thing, but by St. George, she's a fearful lass when riled."
He gave me a wink and I moved on, heart pounding. I hoped the nervousness didn't show. Heap was on the stage, but Legree had taken his place and was keeping a surreptitious eye on me from 700 tables away. The temporal field displacement technology worked in his favour. Every table was next to every other. All of a sudden, there was a strong smell of beer.
"Miss Next!"
"Sir John, good evening!" Falstaff looked me up and down. I didn't wear a dress that often, and I crossed my arms defensively.
"Resplendent, my dear, resplendent!"
he exclaimed, pretending to be something of an expert. "Thank you." Usually I avoided Falstaff, but if I was being watched, it made sense to talk to as many people as possible. If Tweed and TGC thought I could throw a spanner in the works, I would not help them by drawing attention to my genuine confederates.
"I know of a side room, Mistress Next, a small place of an acquainting manner, a niche d'amour. What say you and I retire to that place where you might learn there how I came by the name Falstaff?"
"Another time."
"Really?"
he asked, surprised by my albeit accidental acquiescence.
"No, not really, Sir John,"
I said hurriedly.
"Phew,"
he said, mopping his brow.
"'Twould not be half the sport if you were to lie with me. Resistance, Mistress Next, is rich allurement indeed."
"If resistance is all you seek," I told him, smiling, "then you will never have a keener woman to woo."
"I'll drink to that,"
he laughed heartily. The word might have been written for him. "I have to leave you, Sir John. No more than a gallon of beer an hour, remember?" I patted his large tum, which was as hard and unyielding as a beer barrel.
"On my word,"
he replied, wiping the froth from his beard. I reached the jurisdiction table. Beatrice and Benedict were arguing, as usual.
"Ah,"
said Benedict as soon as I sat down. "'Tis beauty that dost oft make women proud, but God he knows Beatrice share their office small."
"How so?" replied Beatrice. "That face of yours that hungry cannibals would not have touched."
"Have either of you seen the bellman?" I asked. They said they hadn't, and I left them to their arguing as Foyle sat down next to me. I had seen him at Norland Park from time to time. He was jurisfiction, too.
Hello. We haven't been introduced. Gully Foyle is my name. Terra is my nation. Deep space is my dwelling place, and death's my destination. I police science fiction.
I shook his hand. Thursday next. Call me Thursday. How are you liking the awards?
Pretty good.
I was disappointed that Hamlet won the Shakespearean character you'd most like to slap award. My money was on Othello.
Well, Othello won dopiest Shakespearean lead, and they don't like them to win more than one each.
Is that how it works? Foyle mused. The voting system makes no sense to me.
They say you'll be partnered at jurisfiction with Emperor Zark, I said, more by way of conversation than anything else.
I hope not. We've been trying to raise the intellectual and philosophical status of science fiction for some time now. People like him don't help the cause one iota.
Why's that?
Well, mused Foyle, how can I put it? Zark belongs to what we describe as lesser science fiction, or winsome, or maybe even classic.
How about crap?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
There was a burst of applause as the MC announced the next award.
Ladies, gentlemen, and things, he declared. We had asked Dorothy to present the next award, but she was, sadly, kidnapped by flying monkeys just before the show. I will therefore read the nominations myself.
The MC sighed. Dorothy's absence was just the latest in a number of small problems that usually interrupted the smooth running of the show. Earlier, Rumpelstiltskin had gone berserk and attacked someone who guessed his name. Mary Elliott from Persuasion had declared herself too unwell to collect the most tiresome Austin character award, and Boo Radley couldn't be persuaded to come out of his dressing room.
So, carried on the MC, the nominations for the Best Dead Person in Fiction Award are as follows.
He looked at the back of the envelope.
First nomination, Count Dracula.
There was a brief burst of applause, mixed with a few jeers.
Yes, indeed, exclaimed the MC. The Supreme Dark Lord himself, father of an entire subgenre. From his castle in the Carpathians, he embarked upon the world and darkened shadows forever. Let's read a little bit.
He placed a short extract under the imaginotransference device, and I felt a cold shadow on my neck as the Dark Lord's description entered my imagination.
There, in one of the great boxes, of which there were 50 in all, on a pile of newly dug earth, lay the Count. He was either dead or asleep. I could not say which, for the eyes were open and stony, but without the glassiness of death, and the cheeks had the warmth of life through all their pallor, and the lips were as red as ever. But there was no sign of movement, no pulse, no breath, no beating of the heart. I bent over him to find any sign of life, but in vain. There was applause and the lights came up again.
From the undead to the very dead, the second nomination is for a man who returns selflessly from the grave to warn his erstwhile business partner the terrors which await him if he does not change his ways. All the way from A Christmas Carol, Jacob Marley.
The same face, the very same. Marley in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights and boots. The tassels on the latter bristling, like his pigtail and his coat skirts, and the hair upon his head. The chain he drew was clasped about his middle. It was long and wound about him like a tail. And it was made, for Scrooge observed it closely, of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses wrought in steel. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. I glanced across at Marley at the Christmas Carol table. Through his semi-transparent form, I could see Scrooge pulling a large Christmas cracker with Tiny Tim. When the applause died down, the MC announced the third nomination.
Banquo's Ghost from Macbeth. A slain friend and bloody revenge are on the menu in this Scottish play of power and obsession in the 11th century. Is Macbeth the master of his own destiny, or the other way round? Let's have a look. Enter Ghost. Macbeth.
Avaunt, and quit my sight. Let the earth hide thee. Thy bones are marrowless, thy blood is cold. Thou hast no speculation in those eyes which thou dost glare with.
Lady Macbeth, think of this, good peers, but as a thing of custom.
'Tis no other, only it spoils the pleasure of the time.
Macbeth,
what man dare, I dare. Approach thou like the rugged Russian bear, the armed rhinoceros, or the hearken tiger. Take any shape but that, and my firm nerve shall never tremble.
Or be alive again, and dare me to the desert with my sword.
If trembling I inhabit then, protest me the baby of a girl. Hence, horrible shadow, unreal mockery, hence!
Exit ghost. And the winner is, announced the MC, opening the envelope, Count Dracula. The applause was deafening as the Count walked up to receive his award. He shook hands with the MC and took the statuette before turning to the audience. He was white and cadaverous, and I shivered involuntarily.
First,
said the Count, in a soft voice with a slight lisp.
My thanks go to Bram for his admirable reporting of my activities. I would also like to thank Lucy, Mr. Harker, and Van Helsing.
I hope he's not going to start crying like he did last year,
said a voice close to my ear. I turned to find the Cheshire Cat sitting precariously on a seat back.
It's so embarrassing.
But he did. The Count was soon choking back floods of tears, thanking everyone he could think of and generally making a complete fool of himself. How are you enjoying the awards? I said to the Cat, glad to see a friendly face.
Not bad. I think Orlando was a bit miffed to lose out to Puss in Boots for the Best Talking Cat Award.
My money was on you.
Was it really?
Said the Cat, smiling even more broadly.
You are nice. Do you want some advice?
Indeed I do. The Cheshire Cat had always remained totally impartial at jurisdiction. 100 bellmans could come and go, but the Cat would always be there, and his knowledge was vast. I leaned closer.
Okay,
he announced grandly.
Here's the advice. Are you ready?
Yes.
Don't get off a bus while it's still moving.
That's very good advice, I said slowly. Thank you very much.
Don't mention it,
said the Cat, and vanished.
Hello, Thursday.
Hi, Randolph, how are things?
Okay,
he said slightly doubtfully. Have you seen Lola?
No.
Unlike her to miss a party, he muttered. Do you think she's okay? I think Lola can look after herself. Why are you so interested?
I'm going to tell her that I quite like her, he answered resolutely.
Why stop there?
You mean tell her I really like her?
And more, but it's a good place to start.
Thanks. If you see her, tell her I'm on the unplaced generics table.
I wished him good luck and he left. I got up and walked to a curtained-off area where several bookies were taking bets. I placed 100 on Jay Gatsby to win the Most Troubled Romantic Lead Male Award. I didn't think he would win. I just wanted Tweed to waste time trying to figure out what I was up to. I joined the Caversham Heights table soon afterwards and sat down next to Mary, who had returned for the awards. What's going on in the book? She demanded indignantly. Jack tells me he's been changing a few things whilst I've been away.
Just a few, I said. But don't worry. We wouldn't write anything embarrassing for you without consultation.
Her eyes flicked across to Arnie, who was sharing a joke with Captain Nemo and Agatha Diesel.
Just as well, she replied.
The evening drew on, the celebrities announcing the nominations becoming more important as the categories became more highly regarded. Best Romantic Male went to Darcy, and Best Female in a Coming-of-Age Book went to Scout Finch. I looked at the clock. Only 10 minutes to go before the prestigious Most Troubled Romantic Lead, Male, was due to be announced. The female version of this award had been well represented by Thomas Hardy. Bathsheba Everdeen and Tess Durbeyfield, her had both made it to the nominations, only to be pipped at the post by the surprise winner, Lady Macbeth. Sylvia Plath was shortlisted but was disqualified for being real. I got up and walked to the jurisdiction table as a drum roll announced the final category. The bellman nodded politely to me and I looked around the room. It was time to act. Ultra Word was not the saviour of the book world. It would be the end, and I hoped that Mimi down in the footnotophone conduits was ready. Mimi was standing outside the footnotophone tube entrance to text Grand Central and looking at her watch. The words sped backwards and forwards, darting inside the tunnel, which had a sturdy grate across it streaked with rust. Every now and then messages were deflected off. It was a textual sieve, used here for deleting unwanted junk footnotophone messages. She gestured to the man accompanying her and stepped back. Quasimodo, who had found sanctuary finally, grunted in reply and gently placed Das Kapital next to Mein Kampf, separating them only by a thin metal sheet. The book sandwich was held together by rubber bands and a string was attached to the metal sheet. Quasimodo tied the books to the grate, then retired down the conduit, paying out the string as he went. He joined Mimi at a little-used subgenre pipe entitled Squid Action / Adventure and waited for Thursday's signal. And now, ladies, gentlemen and things, for the high point of the evening, the 923rd Annual Book World Award for Most Troubled Romantic Lead, Male. To read the nominations, we have none other than Wordmaster Xavier Libris, all the way from Text Grand Central. There was loud applause, which I hadn't expected. TGC wasn't that popular. I had a sudden attack of doubt. Could Dean be wrong? I thought again about Perkins, Snell, and Havisham, and my resolve returned. I grabbed my bag and got up. I saw Legree stiffen and rise from the Uncle Tom's cabin table, speaking into his cuff as he did so. I headed towards the exit with him tailing me. "Thank you very much," said Libris, raising his hands to quell the applause, as Hamlet, Jude Fawley, and Heathcliff stood close by, each wishing that Libris would hurry up so they could collect the statuette. "I have a few words to say about the new operating system, and then we can all get back to the awards." He took a deep breath. "Many good words have been written about Ultra Word, and I have to tell you, they are all true. The benefits to everyone will be felt throughout the book world, from the lowliest D10 in the trashiest paperback to the finest A1 in high literature." I walked to the side of the stage towards the swing doors that led through to the hospitality lounge. Legree followed but was tripped up by Matthias's widow. She placed a hoof on his chest and held him firm while Mrs. Hubbard grabbed one arm and Miss Muffet the other. It had been done so quietly, no one had noticed. "Non-fiction is gaining in popularity, and this invasion into areas historically part of fiction must be cut off at the root. To this end, myself and the technicians at Text Grand Central have created Ultra Word, the book operating system that gives us more choice, more plots, more ideas, and more ways in which to work. With these tools, you and I will forge a new fiction, a fiction so varied that the readers will flock to us in droves. The future is bright. The future is Ultra Word." "Going somewhere, missy?" asked Heap, blocking my path. "Get out of my way, Uriah." He pulled a gun from his pocket but stopped dead when a voice said,
"Do you know what an eraser head can do to an A7 like you, Heap?"
Bradshaw emerged from behind a potted triffid. He was carrying his trusty hunting rifle.
"You'd never kill a featured Dickens character, Mr. Bradshaw," said Heap, attempting to call his bluff.
Bradshaw pulled back the hammer on his rifle.
"Poltroon! Ever wondered what happened to Edwin Drood?"
Heap's eyes nearly popped out of his skull, and coward that he was, he dropped his pistol and started pleading for his life. Mrs. Bradshaw tied Heap's thumbs together and, after gagging him, hid him under the summer lightning table. "Drood?" I asked Bradshaw with some surprise. "Was that you?"
"Not at all," he laughed. "I only asked him if he had ever wondered what happened to Drood.
Now get out of here, girlie. There's work to be done.
I pushed the swing doors to the hospitality lounge and pulled out my mobile footnotophone. The room was deserted, but I met Tweed at the entrance to the stage. I could see Libris talking, and beyond him, the audience hanging on his every word.
Of course, he went on, the new system will need new work procedures, and all of you have had ample time to study our detailed 1,700-page prospectus. All jobs will be protected. The status of all generics will be maintained. In a few minutes, I will ask for a vote to carry the new system, as required by the Council of Genres. But before we do, let us go over the main points again. Firstly, UltraWord will support the possibility of a no-frills range of books with only 43 different words, none of them longer than 6 letters, designed for the hard of reading. These... I leaned forward and spoke to Tweed as Libris carried on. Is that why you invited all the C and D class generics, Tweed?
What do you mean?
So you could force the vote?
Your lies have the greatest effect on those with little influence in the well. Give them the power to change something and they'll meekly follow you. After Libris has finished, I'll give a rebuttal. When I'm done, you and Libris and UltraWord will be history.
Tweed glared at me as Libris went on to his third point. UltraWord is too important to be loused up by you, said Tweed with a sneer. I agree there might be certain downsides, but overall the benefits far outweigh the drawbacks.
Benefits to who, Tweed? You and Kane?
Of course. And you, too, if only you'd stop meddling.
What did Kane buy you with?
He didn't buy me next. We merged. His contacts in the Outland and my position at Jurisfiction. A fictional person in the real world and a real person in fiction. A better partnership it would be hard to imagine.
When they hear what I have to say, I replied calmly, they'll never give you the vote.
Tweed smiled that supercilious smile of his and stepped aside. You want to have your say Thursday? Go ahead. Make a fool of yourself. But remember this, anything you say, we can refute. We can modify the rules, change the facts, deny the truth with written proof. That's the beauty of UltraWord. Everything can be keyed in direct from Text Grand Central, and as you've so correctly gathered, everything there is controlled by Kane, Libris and I. It's as easy to change the facts as it is to write a sub-axle failure on the Bluebird. Or unlock a padlock. Put Godot in a bag or create an outbreak of misspelling virus. Merely keystrokes next. We have the great library within our control. With the source text at our fingertips, we can do anything. History will be good to us, because we are the ones who shall write it. Tweed laughed. Battle against UltraWord, and you might as well try and canoe up a waterfall. He patted me patronizingly on the shoulder. But just in case you've got something up your sleeve, 6,000 highly trained Mrs. Danvers are on call, ready to move in on my word. We can even write a Bookworld Rebellion if we want. The Council won't be able to tell the difference between a real one and a written one. We will have this vote Thursday.
Yes, you might, I conceded. All I want is for the characters to have their say with all the facts, not just yours.
I looked at Libris on the stage.
Point 10, he went on as Heathcliff looked at his watch impatiently. All characters, wherever they reside, will be given 4 weeks holiday a year in whichever book they choose.
There was a roar of applause. He was offering everything they wanted to hear, buying the inhabitants of the book world with hollow promises.
Tweed spoke into his mobile footnotophone.
Miss Next wants to have her say.
I saw Libris touch his ear and turn round to stare at me contemptuously.
But before the vote, he added, before you say the word and we move upwards into broad, sunlit pastures, I understand we have a jurisfiction agent who wants to offer a counterpoint to my statement. This is her right. It is your right to ask for proof if you wish, and I most strongly request that you do so. Ladies and gentlemen, things... Miss Thursday next,
I murmured into my mobile footnotophone.
Go, Mimi, go.
Mimi nodded to Quasimodo, who pulled the string. The steel plate shot out and Das Kapital and Mein Kampf came together. their conflicting ideologies starting to generate heat. The books turned brown, smouldered for a moment, and then, as Mimi and Quasimodo scurried away up their retreat, the two volumes reached critical mass, turned white-hot, and exploded. The detonation echoed down the footnotophone pipes, followed by a deathly silence. They had done it. The footnotophone conduit was destroyed. Libris and Tweed were cut off from Text Grand Central. Everyone in the Starlight Room reacted slightly to the distant explosion. Tweed steadied himself and spun round to glare at me.
What was that?
I patted him patronizingly on the shoulder. It's called Leveling the Playing Field, Harris.